We wanted to discuss today how to put things in proper order, how to make our speaking orderly. We've already prepared, we've gathered our information, we have our thoughts collected, but now they have to be put in an order that works. Now, what happens when we don't put them in order is that we're darting around from place to place. We mention something, and then we go off in another direction, and then we come back and say, oh, one other thing about point A, and then we go back to point D, and then back to point B, and this way and that way. It doesn't help. It gives the impression to the audience that you're disconnected in your thoughts. It's not a strong structure. It's not a straight way to go. The more you can plan out how your thoughts will fit together, how you're going to develop them, the more effectively you'll be able to present the ideas. There's a beginning, and from the beginning, you develop your thoughts until they wrap up in a conclusion. That's the general scope. Now, there are different plans which can be given. And in coming lessons, you'll find plans for how you might open, plans for how you might close. But the general plan I've given you here, you start off with something that gets people's attention right away. You give a little preview of what's coming up. Then you discuss your points. Point A, amplification of it, evidence for it, discussion of it. Point B, amplification, evidence or discussion. Point C, which leads into point D, which naturally takes you to point E. And finally you get to the end, point F, the wrap up, the conclusion. And you end up with a strong point. Either an appeal, we want you to do this, or a statement, you should always remember that, a conclusion. Another thing that happens if you don't have order is that you find yourself going on and on and on about the same point. I have one godbrother I know, he starts with a point, and then he expresses the point in different words. And then he sort of rephrases it and says it again. And then he says it again. And after he said it about 5 or 6 times, he's run out of ways to say it, he goes on to another point. Because he doesn't have in mind what he's going to say next. He doesn't have in mind what he's going to say next. So have it in mind. Have a plan. Don't memorize verbatim. Don't speak from notes. That kind of planning where everything's locked in is not what I have in mind. But planned as a Yogyapati Prabhu's talk yesterday in the Bhagavatam class was planned. Thoughts are there. You're in an order. You have a little freedom. You're not locked into every sentence, but you know where you're going. You know where the path leads. You're not doubling back and taking little side excursions. You're pretty much going in a straight line, and anything that you pull in from the side is fine, but it advances your purpose. Okay. I have a quotation. This one's Napoleon. The art of war is a science in which nothing succeeds which has not been calculated and thought out. When you speak sentences, you plan them in advance, don't you? Otherwise you say something, well, it kind of has to do with, choosing or not choosing and going or not going. I mean, it's all part of, like, it's the same. You know what I mean? Of course the person doesn't know what you meant. But if we're reasonably articulate, we plan out a sentence. We have an idea what the subject is going to be, what the verb is going to be, what the predicate is going to be. We plan it out. So what I'm suggesting is that as we plan out our sentences, we similarly plan out blocks and, in fact, the whole picture. Now, one of the persons who's really, in my mind, outstanding in this regard is Tamal Krishna Maharaj. He gives extremely well-organized lectures, impressively, astoundingly
well-organized lectures. Every time I hear him speak, I'm impressed with how methodical his lectures are. So, while I was in New York and planning out this course, one of the things I did was take a train ride with Tamal Krishna Maharaj and discuss how he puts together his lectures. So here are some of the points from Tamal Krishna Maharaj. First thing he said, which I'm sure is true, he said, my mind just thinks organizationally. He has that kind of mind. He thinks very methodically and organizationally. He knows what he wants to get across before he even begins. And his introduction gets people ready for what he's going to say. He starts right off. He knows what he's going to do. So right from the word go, from the very start, he sets people up. Then he also said he doesn't like loose ends. He wraps them up. He keeps in mind, I've said this, but I haven't finished it. I started this point, I didn't complete it. So he doesn't leave it untidy. If he starts something, he finishes it. Maybe he jumps and takes in a wider point, but then he doesn't leave that end untied. He wraps it up. Maybe he'll tie up three knots at once. Open something, open something, open something, and bring them all to a close at once. But he's methodical. He's got in mind what's open and what's closed, what's started and what's completed. Next point is that when he speaks, naturally ends in a conclusion. Because he started out with that in mind, that I'm going to bring home this point. So he starts out with an introduction that sets people up to understand the point, then he develops it, and closes. Now he gave some very nice examples. He said that the lecture you have to see as a whole. You have to see what it is as a whole. And he gave the example that when you're worshiping the deity, you're working with details. Earrings and bracelets and shawls and flowers. But if you're a good pujari, you're conscious not only of the particular ornament that you're fixing, but how the deity is going to look. When the people are standing 20 feet away, how's everything going to look? How's the deity going to appear? What's the backdrop going to be like? Where are the flower vases going to be? What's the whole picture? You have that in mind while you're fixing in Radharani's earring or Krishna's peacock feather. So similarly, you have in mind the basic shape or structure or plan of what your lecture is going to bring about. Another point he made is that you can't, he said, I don't think that a Krishna conscious person is sloppy. I don't think a Krishna conscious person is sloppy. But in his habits, or in the way he does things, he's orderly. Srila Prabhupada was so orderly. Everything, if you looked at his desk, everything was in a place. And if you ever saw him pick something up or put it down, it would seem practically as though the thing had a trajectory. You know, an exact place it had to be in, an exact way for it to get there. And Srila Prabhupada would always follow it precisely. Everything was so precisely placed. He was careful, in other words. He was careful. If he was doing a fire sacrifice, there was some Gayatri sheet left over. Don't throw it. Let's see. Don't throw it. Keep it careful. He used to collect pennies. He had a little, you know, those ink eradicator metal containers, Eaton's in America. He had one of those, the 26 Second Avenue, filled with pennies. Because everything has a place and a purpose. So in our speaking, everything has a place, everything has a purpose. So a devotee's life is regulated. He gets up at a certain time, he takes rest at a certain time, and therefore he has a certain mentality. Bhakti Charvamaraj was saying, we're developing the mode of goodness. We're developing, and in the mode of goodness, things are peaceful, things are orderly, things go in a certain way. So if we cultivate that consciousness as devotees, then when we get up to speak, we're not going to be confused and bewildered and uncertain about which way to go, we simply take into account what it is that we're doing, what's the circumstance, what's the subject matter, how to present it, and then, with a clear mind, present it. That's, therefore, it's all tied in with our Krishna consciousness. Regulated life, sadhana, clear-mindedness. Now, not every one of us is as organized as Tamal Krishna Maharaj. Few of us ever will be as organized as Tamal Krishna Maharaj. We just may not think that way. Therefore, for some of us, some notes may be required. You might prefer to outline your topic. Gurujan Prabhu, for those who attended his writing class, has some neat little systems for figuring out what you're going to write about or think about or speak about. So do that. Spend a little time. You may not outline every Bhagavatam lecture. You may not write extensive notes. But it may sometimes help you. If you find that your lectures are very disorganized, that you really aren't sure where to go, that you're lacking in organization and it would help you, write yourself a few notes. Just A, B, C, D. It might just be Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakta, Sarvadharman Paratyaja. Two more verses. And story about Prabhupada in Berlin. That's all it might be, three or four notes. But that gives you a little bit of a structure. I'm going to go here, I'll go here, and Krishna will help you fill in places in between. Those notes you may or may not refer to. If you're making extensive notes, I would suggest you not refer to them. Do it beforehand, then put them away. But you've thought out your topic. You have some idea what it's all about. And you'll have an oversupply, not an undersupply. And you'll know where to fit things in. Any questions? Yes.
In terms of an introduction and mention together.
Yes.
I've heard also Prabhupada speak and other, say, scholarly devotees, and it seems like sometimes the scholarly approach is that you may start with the simplest thing. Mm-hmm. Like, for example, I heard one wonderful lecture on Lord Balaram that wound up extremely esoteric and so many wonderful points. But at the beginning of the lectures, there are three aspects of the absolute truth. Brahman, Bhagavan, you know, and explain them. So I'm wondering, I was sitting there and thinking, you know, I already know these things, you know. But I'm wondering if that's a proper way also to proceed. Because it's some kind of like a very general thing that everybody knows and just building your points and so on.
You have to decide what works best, what fits best. Sometimes the best way to get attention is simply to say, today I'm going to talk about this. Prabhupada would sometimes do that. Today our subject matter is. Sometimes, and we'll get into this more in coming days, it comes in a day or so, how you might open talk. Sometimes it's a story. If you read some of Srila Prabhupada's old Back to Godhead articles. One time I was riding on a train with my five-year-old son, and such thing happened, and a gentleman came up and asked this question, and the boy answered, or sometimes Prabhupada would say, so Shamsundar's daughter asked her father, Father, when you were a child, were you a boy or a girl? He'd start with something. And naturally you've got everyone with an open like that, opening like that. There are lots of different ways to open talks, and we'll discuss that in the coming day. But the main point I would make is open. Don't waste time. So I'm very glad to be here today, and actually it's been a long time since I was here. And, don't do that. Know where you're going to start. Be ready to speak. Have your beginning planned out. It's a launch. Be ready. Another point. Yes. No. I didn't. My handout, whatever you get at the beginning, that's all I'm handing out. So anything else that I say that you think you might want to preserve, write down or remember. If anyone wanted to pick up in more detail what Vimal Krishnamurti said to me. I have it, and you can copy it down. Yes, Mr. Rupam. Loud, please.
Sometime during Srimad Bhagavatam class, the devotees start to speak about similar blessing with the verse of Prabhupada. Is that completely inappropriate or it's possible?
We'll talk about Srimad Bhagavatam class specifically in coming classes, but to answer your question, it may be. It may be. Sometimes Srila Prabhupada would do that. He'd speak from the verse and he'd just use it as a place to make a point. He'd know where he was going. But today I'm not going to talk so much about this verse. I'm going to talk about this point which needs to be heard. It's not a rule that you must follow the verse if you have something important to say. We'll talk more about that later. But there's also a consideration that one has a duty to explain the subject matter. So we get class after class after class in which the speaker ignores entirely the subject matter presented by Srila Prabhupada or by Vyasadeva. We may find ourselves in a disheartening situation.
Could you explain a little bit more detail the guidelines of timing?
Yeah. The main point of your, the main bulk of your talk is the discussion. Your introduction is by nature or by necessity brief, because its purpose is to capture someone. It's hard to capture someone with a long, drawn-out introduction. You want to make it snappy. You want to make it quick and snappy. You want to capture it. Now there are techniques where you sort of work the person into it. You meander a little bit and take him on an excursion, and after a little while he suddenly found that there he is right in the middle of your lecture. And that's one technique. But generally most techniques involve rather quickly capturing the person's attention right off with some startling statement or a question or what have you. So that's done briefly. Then most of your time you're going to spend explaining what it is you have to say. And finally, at the end, you drive home your conclusion. So that's also a short business. Now, it may differ from place to place. If you're giving a lecture to high school students about traffic safety, this is an example given, you may be spending about 80% of your time, you know, making sure you've got the guy's attention, the kid's attention, you know, really capturing their minds in different ways. And then the rest of it's conclusion. And practically no discussion. It depends. But this is general. Capture their attention quickly. Speak your arguments. Say your piece. And hammer home your final point.
And speaking to the devotees about what the Bhagavad Gita verse, is it necessary to get into this kind of rational introduction?
No. No. It's not. You don't have. This doesn't call for flashiness. When we say plan, when we say structure, when we say beginning, middle, and end, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're taxing your mind.
Something like a story or something written to show that it shouldn't be necessary to consider how philosophy and public purposes.
It shouldn't, but it may be. Just like Shukadeva Goswami, they could have just spoken philosophy, or Vyasadeva could have just laid out the ideas of the Bhagavatam. But he starts with the stories. Stuck to the story. It's all wrapped up with a story about Maharaj Pariksit and Sukadeva Goswami and so on. All of us, and we have experience of our Bhagavatam classes, we're not all filled with rapt attention from minute one to minute 60. If we were, then sure. But these principles apply generally. They're general principles which hold true everywhere. We want our attention captured. It doesn't have to be flashy. It could just be getting right into it. This word Rajan is really an important word.
Rajan?
Rajan. Oh, any verse with Rajan. This word is very important. That could be your opening. This word Rajan is extremely important. You start that way. Start. have a beginning place and get right into it. Don't meander and wander and wonder. Know where you're going to start. I'm going to start by pointing out this word Rajan. Rajan. And I'll develop it. And then I'll reach a conclusion. Therefore, the kings of the world should be saintly persons, not the dogs that we have now. And end. End means, conclusion means, finish. The most important thing about your conclusion is that after you've made it, stop. That's the hardest, that's the biggest mistake we make in conclusions. When we've reached it, we keep going. Don't. If you don't do anything flashy, anything spectacular, anything even particularly emphatic, when you reach your conclusion, at least do this. Stop. Don't. Well, I guess that's about all I had to say, so thank you very much, and I guess I'll stop here. Don't. Just stop. Any other points? Yes.
In the Bhagavatam class, you reach your conclusion, you stop, you're allowing time for questions.
Yes.
So questions will you be able to answer?
Yes, we'll get into that. Questions, leaving time for them, how to deal with them, what to do if there are none. Yeah.
What is the difference between Bhagavatam class and Krishna class?
Not much. It's the same thing, really. Krishna Katha. Just the only difference I can perceive is which book you're reading from. And one's in the morning, one's at night. Yes.
And the devotee, I saw the class by going to the purport that Srila Prabhupada gives. And, you know, they read two, three sentences, and then they comment on that.
That's fine. We'll have at least one or two classes specifically devoted to how to give Bhagavatam classes. But I see no objection, and rather, particularly if the purport's long, that may be a good way to sustain attention. Because when people see us just reading, 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 they tend to stop listening. And it's a way of keeping people's attention to read a little bit, explain a little bit, read some more, explain some more. I see, and Prabhupada himself spoke that way. He would have someone read a little purport, he'd explain, read some more.
Chance that while you're giving a class which you prepared to make them inspired to change it. Does that
yes.
To you?
You do yes. To you? Yes, if you feel inspiration from Krishna and it's clear to you that you want to do something else, change your plan. Making a plan doesn't mean you have to stick to that plan, you may change your plan. Sure. Yes?
Is it an absolute necessity that there be one main theme, or could it happen that the inspiration again leads you on to one theme after another and makes it a variegated
You may have more than one theme. Generally it's recommended writing or in a lecture, you basically have one or a few points that you want to get across. Once you start getting into many, many, many different points, you run the risk that none of them is going to be clearly explained. You may have more than one theme. Srila Prabhupada certainly did take one theme as a starting place for another and then a third. But keep that in mind. All right.
Diction. I've a few more samples of wonderful words from the adolescent slang category. We've already dealt with such old standbys as blow away, blow one's cool, blow one's mind, blow out, burn, burned out. Now you can add to that far out, flip out, freak out, fry, get off on. Good solid drug term, get off on. On a downer, on a bummer, bummed out, on a trip, right on, a good standard overused phrase which is gradually being replaced in some circles by spot on, if that means anything to you, spaced out, scope out, super, everything's super, super tired, super, super enthusiastic, super, super, super. Super is not bad, and sometimes super may be a very good word to use, but if you find yourself addicted to super, maybe it's not so super. Toasted? You can be fried, burned out, or toasted. And generally, if we're toasted, we're toasted to the max. Fried to a crisp, toasted to the max. If you're really an old timer, you might still be turned on. And of course, that's where it's at. Any one of these terms may at any time be precisely the term that you want to use. And certainly we're not going to crucify anyone for using any of these terms from time to time. But just consider the cumulative effects of building a vocabulary consisting largely of that kind of language. After talking about the guy who's bummed out, then you talk about the other guy who's really spaced and the other guy who's on a trip, and then you talk about the super enthusiastic book distributor who's turned on to the max. Then you crash for a while. And on and on and on. There's nothing wrong with any of these terms, but when we build a vocabulary saturated with this kind of language, then something is wrong. Something is wrong, or something is poverty-stricken. You know, our diction is becoming poverty-stricken. It just requires a little bit of care and thought and attention. And if you give that care, thought, and attention, particularly in your lectures, and even when you're talking with guests, and even when we're speaking among devotees, it will be to our profit. Any questions? That comes up in the next part of this lecture, which maybe we'll get to right now since you gave me a bridge to it. I'm going to write something on the board. Should we let these rebels get away with disrupting our institution? What do you think?
No.
No. Why should we let these rebels get away with disrupting our institution?
What does it mean, disrupting this?
It means making a mess out of the whole thing. Are we going to let them get away with it or not?
Well, that's not really what they're rebels. To get away with?
With disrupting everything.
Why?
They're rebelling, that's what they're doing. We have a smooth, orderly system, and these people are just rebelling, and they're trying to tear everything apart.
What are they doing?
What are they doing? They're distributing papers, they're holding meetings, they're publishing all sorts of unusual things. They refuse to cooperate.
What are they publishing?
Blasphemy.
What do they say?
They say, we shouldn't listen, we shouldn't cooperate with the authorities, shouldn't follow their instructions anymore.
All of them?
Well, enough. I mean, it starts with a little thing that just snowballs.
But do they have reason in their arguments?
Well, okay. That's how we get to the substance of the thing. This argument, it's not much of an argument, depends mainly on the words. Of course, every argument uses words. These words happen to be charged. rebels. Let them get away with disrupting our institutions. Now,
the way you deal with charged words, which is what a lot of argument consists of,
is that you look at the words and you think about how you might otherwise put it. How you might, what's the neutral equivalent of the term? Or what's even the favorable equivalent of the term? I've given you some examples on your sheets there, haven't I?
The second sheet, which I don't have a copy of. Could someone give me a copy of sheets number 2 and 3? Thank you.
Thank you.
Can you explain the sheet about?
Pardon me? What order do they follow in?
Yeah, we've got 2, 5, and 1, 6.
Okay, the reason you got that, the speakings are numbered consecutively, and the arguings are numbered consecutively. So you've got 5, which is separate, that comes after yesterday's, which was 4, and you have 5 and 6 in the arguing department, and 7 will come tomorrow.
And there's no 6 in the arguing department?
5 and 6 go together. They're both part of straight thinking. That's why they both say straight thinking on the top.
But it's strong speaking 6 is 5.
This comes tomorrow. You have 5 today, you'll get 6 tomorrow.
The numbers are in 2 lines. 1 for speaking, 1 for arguing.
Okay. So if you look at that, you'll see, for example, that a religion, which is a very good thing, could also be a cult, which is a very bad thing. Or a group, which could be either. Educational materials, which are very good, could be propaganda, which is not good. Or it could just be books and pamphlets. Concerned parents could be narrow-minded parents. It could just be parents. Community leaders could be politicians. Or they could just be spokesmen.
Now, this particular statement that we have here, put neutrally, might be, should we allow these dissenters to bring about changes in our society? Really the same proposition. What's a rebel but a dissenter? And what's disruption? It's bringing about changes. And a society is simply a less solid, less charged term than institution. Should we allow these dissenters to bring about changes in our institution? Well, that's something we might want to be a little more open to. And if you put it on the other side of the spectrum, should we give these reformers a chance to clean up our bureaucracy? Should we give these reformers a chance to clean up our bureaucracy? It's the same question. The same group of people trying to do the same thing, resisted by the same opposition. You're simply playing with words. So watch the words that people are using. They have not only denotation, what they mean, but connotation, what they imply, and their emotional impact, what they make you feel. That's what makes a prostitute different from a whore. Or a society girl. Or an escort. Now they've become respectable, they're escorts.
It means prostitute.
Usually.
Emotionally charged words. I commend to you chapter 1 of Straight and Crooked Thinking. I'm not going to assign it as homework because my impression is that everyone, like me, is pretty well racing to keep up pace with all the other classes that are going on. It's not required reading, but either today or in coming days, read chapter 1 where this subject matter of emotionally charged words is described. And watch out for them. Just in your ordinary discussions with people, when they use words like rebel and disrupting our institution and all sorts of things like that, take a second to think critically about it.
What is that rebel? Why is he a rebel? What's it mean? What is this get away with? You mean we're going to let him do something? So what is it? Was it Vishnumurti or Dhrudramurti? Does he have reasons? What are the reasons? What is actually his position? What is he saying? What is he proposing and why? Before we just get all involved in the language, what is actually going on here? That's the point.
Now, I have a little bit more time, which I'm going to use, to explain. You also see on your sheet, I've drawn attention to how it can be done with verbs. This is especially done in newspapers. The newspapers specialize in saying, reporting the facts, but what the facts, how the facts hit you, completely depend on how it's presented. And the example is given there. If you read it, you'll see how the same statement, "This is my house," can be viewed about 10 or 15 different ways, depending on simple change of verb. Okay. So train yourself when you're reading, when you're discussing, to see what people are doing to you or trying to do to you with their words. Be prepared for it. Now, three more tricks with words. Organize myself a little bit here. Yes?
Two questions. How does one go about the meeting in a practical discussion with someone who presents a standing question about the board? And also, is there any way that positively that sort of argument, that sort of standard can be used for the rest of the argument?
And you can use
your topic things?
That you can use can you use this? Yeah, you can do it. Any of the techniques that I'm going to present to you as being tricky or even fallacious, you can use. You can use tautologies, you can use ad hominem arguments, attacking the person instead of the argument. You can use any of these. They're all dirty tricks. You can use them. Be careful. We do use them. We should make effective use of our language. If you want to put something down, use a pejorative. Sure. We all do it, but watch, know what you're doing. And when someone calls you and says, well, isn't that term a little extreme? Then be prepared to talk about what the issue is. If your words become too bombastic, you may find that you're losing your audience. You have to see who you're talking to, what the circumstances are. Scholars may not be impressed by this sort of thing.
Yes?
I had experienced Jagatguru Swami was preaching in Nairobi, and he was speaking to African people who were, say, less educated than other people in other parts of the world. At first he started try to give a lecture speaking about, you know, philosophy. But then he actually got an idea from the Christians. He started talking about hell and heaven, you know, but then he got people's attention because he started getting more sensational, and that got through to them.
Sensationalism can be good. I'm not saying language like this should be out. Don't make your language clinical, super analytical, super. Don't make it dry. Use it, but know what you're doing and know what's being done to you. That's my point.
This would be an example. We were reading in the second canto of Prabhupada. Instead of using the term family, he used band of relatives.
Yeah. It's completely legitimate. Use whatever language gets across your point, what the facts are and how you feel about them. But don't get confused about the difference between the two. Don't let it throw you. Okay? I'm not at all campaigning. I use language like this all the time. And you're perfectly free to use it. But know the difference between what the facts are and what the words are.
Yes. I've back from experience in preaching, like, this is like a heavy statement, so sometimes you're speaking very fully, and then you get a heavy statement, and at the end of that you are detached, it has very effect.
Srila Prabhupada, in that same discussion I quoted the other day with the old man who was attached to Radha Krishna, Prabhupada explained to him, sometimes strong words are needed to wake a sleeping man. So don't be afraid, don't be timid, don't let me discourage you from using strong words when required. But know how to pierce through those words or stand apart from those words and get down to what the real issues are. Don't get caught up. If someone says, why are they rebels? Rebels is the only word for them. Well, you don't necessarily, you might defend that way if you want to hold a discourse on that level, which might just be the best level. But you might just say, all right, let's examine what it is they're doing. Is it right or is it wrong? Be versatile, the same point I made a few days ago. Have a lot of different approaches in your repertoire, not just one. Okay. A couple more fallacies of interest.
If I get the right page, give me a moment more.
Fallacy one, talking about words, arguing about words, and confusing it with arguing about facts. Krishna consciousness is a cult. It is not a cult. It is too a cult. That's a pointless argument. What do you mean by cult? According to some one definition, sociological definition, it's certainly a cult. Chaitanya cult. Well, let's not waste our time arguing about the words, what do you mean? Another example. Here's a good argument for you. Our present gurus aren't really acharyas. They may be gurus, I'll admit that, but they're not acharyas. Now what are we arguing about here?
What's a guru and acharya?
Yeah, it's just a question of definition. If I accept one definition of acharya, sure, they're all acharyas. If I accept another definition, maybe some are and some aren't. And if I accept another definition, maybe none of them are. Maybe nobody's Ramanujacharya or Madhvacharya. You're not arguing about facts here, you're arguing about words. They are two acharyas, they are not, they are two. Know the difference between arguing about facts and arguing about words. And be prepared to separate them. All right, putting aside what you want to call them, are they bona fide representatives of Srila Prabhupada or are they not? Or there may be three definitions of acharya. That approach is taken by one devotee. There's this one. Acharya means head of an institution. They're not the heads of the institution. Acharya means gurus. Certainly they're gurus. Be prepared to separate the facts from the words. And don't think you're arguing about one when you're arguing about the other. Keep your bearings.
Well, you said not to argue about words, but can we ask for a definition?
Sure. I don't mean not to challenge a word. If somebody says this is a despicable movement of sentimentalists, those are words, they're strong words, and they should be backed up, or as they say, put up or shut up. You should be able to back it up, or you should back down. So we don't just let any words go by. But when there's an argument, when we're really arguing about words, and sometimes we do, we go on and on and on and on, about whether this is a this or it's not a this, then sometimes it's better to put the word aside or say, listen, we're really arguing about the words. Now what are we really talking about? Don't confuse arguing about words with arguing about facts. This also is discussed in a coming chapter of Straight and Crooked Thinking with several clear examples. Yes?
Bhakti Charaswami was talking about that yesterday. We were discussing what it means to take initiation in a spiritual master. He was saying, well, first of all, you know, a spiritual master can have a very broad meaning, and also initiation can mean that you're just accepted the Vaishnava principles.
So one has to
define his terms and has to make clear what he's talking about. Yes?
That is called semantics.
It can be called semantics if you want. We would argue about it.
Next fallacy. Putting forward a tautology
as if it was a fact.
Too much austerity isn't good. That's not a reason for anything. That's not an argument. Because the answer is, well, too much of anything isn't good. You have to be right. Too much of anything isn't good. Now the question is no intoxication, no meat eating, no illicit sex, or no gambling, is that too much austerity or not? That's the issue. And you don't contribute to the argument by saying, too much of this thing is bad. Too much of anything is bad. But once you be prepared to accept immediately, yeah, too much of anything is bad. Excessive anything, not enough of anything. That's called tautology. Too much of this thing is bad. Don't take it seriously.
Is that full knowledge?
Tautology.
Is the definition just too much?
No, it doesn't have to be too much. It can be, it's anything where the descriptive terms used repeat themselves in such a way that makes the truth of the statement inevitable.
It's like a repetition. You put your A and your B on, you balance them out in such a way that it has to be so. Yeah.
How would you refuse to say, well, too much of chanting isn't bad?
Sure, too much of anything is bad. I'll accept it. When you put it like that, too much of anything is bad. Now the question is whether chanting 24 hours a day is too much. Can you glorify God too much? Too much of anything is bad. I'll take that. Okay. Now, what is too much chanting? What is over-glorification of God? Don't fall for it. It's a trap. Too much of this thing is bad.